It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock.
Believe me when I say we have a difficult time ahead of us. But if we are to be prepared for it, we must first shed our fear of it. I stand here without fear because I remember. I remember that I am here not because of the path that lies before me, but because of the path that lies behind me. I remember that for 100 years we have fought these machines. And after a century of war, I remember that which matters most. We are still here! Tonight, let us make them remember. We are not afraid!
Yeah, 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 Thunderstruck here on Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock from the BEA, beautiful studios of Freedoms with a S, freedomsphoenix.com. Here in Phoenix, Arizona, on the line we have Butler Schaefer. He's professor of law at Southwestern University of Law in Los Angeles, and he's written a lot of books. It's been very influential. I want to tell this one story, Butler. Mark J. Victor is one of your students that is a successful criminal defense attorney here, and my partner in the Freedom Summit that we do every year, and you speak out a lot. And I remember one of the things that we did before we started doing the Freedom Summit, I think it was about 2000, he would have, every year or so, he would have an event that was sponsored by his law firm where he would invite a lot of his clients and peers and friends and such, and it would be a luncheon. And there would be, you know, a couple speakers or so on. It was just kind of a, you know, 2-3 hour lunch deal. And you and Vin Cernowitz had a national syndicated column at the time called The Libertarian, and he is still an editor at the Las Vegas Review Journal, largest paper in Nevada. And he's a very popular writer, very good. H.L. Mencken reminds me a lot of him, and it was just a real good observation on the planet. And there was two ideas that were presented, and it was the future of freedom. And you were kind of like, the future of freedom is, I can't remember which one of you took which position, but one said, you know, freedom, man, it gets really nasty. You know, I mean, we're going to get into some bad evil a coming. The other one's like, no, freedom, we trend, you know, pretty good. Humanity's going for the stars. Humanity's trending up. And I remember one of you said, you know, if you talk to the Jews in the Warsaw Ghetto, they probably weren't thinking they were trending up too good. So I kind of, as the years have gone by, I can't remember, both of you were saying pretty much the same thing. It was just, when you take a snapshot of humanity, you're looking at a time that there's all kinds of bad things that go on, but we're trending towards, a lot of times it takes those bad things that happen for us to pick ourselves up and understand and realize how that bad thing happened and to try and avoid that. It's like a kid, you know, touching, you know, the stove. You know, whoa, that's hot. I should not do that anymore. So I'm wondering from you where we're trending. What do we have to go through on this? Are we starting to learn from our mistakes, or we just keep making them over and over? Or where are we at?
Well, that's a good question. I recall that session that you were talking about with Vin and myself. And I think what we kind of disagreed on was the question of whether we're talking about the short term or the long term. I think in the short term, things are going to be very ugly. They're already very ugly. You know, we have largely a police state. We have a war state that insists on being able to go out and conduct wars against whoever the president wants to conduct wars against. We have an economy that is in a very bad state. I don't care what Bernanke and these other clowns want to say about it when they talk about, what do you say, an unusually uncertain recovery. What the heck does that mean? An unusually uncertain. It means that the people who think that they're running the economy, they are not. It's out of their control. And I think that in the long run, the system simply will not be able to sustain itself. All prior civilizations have collapsed, and they've collapsed for pretty much the same reasons that I think ours has basically collapsed. And I don't see it getting any better in terms of saving the civilization, but I think I see it getting better in terms of moving to a new way of thinking about society. And a lot of it is happening already, this decentralization process. And again, the Internet is just one example. People focus on the Internet, but they do so, I think, because it's one of the more obvious instances of what's going on. But there's decentralization in schooling, you know, people taking their kids out of school. There's decentralization in terms of health care, in terms of how businesses operate, and all kinds of areas. We buy so much of our produce at farmers' markets. They're all over the place now. It's superior to grocery stores, even though in many cases the prices are higher. But this is where we are heading because, as I say, these vertically structured systems that we call institutions, the institutional arrangements, they can't sustain themselves. And the reason that they can't is that they insist on a kind of rigidity, an enforced rigidity, that runs counter to the whole life process. Life is change. Life is a constant process of change, and institutions don't like that. They don't like to have things subject to environmental conditions that, a new product that somebody puts out, a new method of competing, an unwillingness of people to anymore, put their kids into those zoos that we call government schools and so forth. All that change arises, and institutions react to it. This is why there's been this recent discussion about giving the president a kill switch over the internet. When people are communicating too freely with one another about whatever it is they want to communicate about, that's going to be contrary to the interests of nation states, the corporate interests that are basically the nation state, and a lot of other institutions. And so we've got to shut it down in much the same way that the church in medieval times tried to shut down alternative ways of thinking about religion.
Because they have their own priest. I mean, they're in the media. They're in their politicians. Yeah. They have their... And one thing I remember, it was 96, 97, around in there. There was a gentleman, his name is Paul Schatt. Well, he passed away not too long ago, but he was the editorial page editor of the Arizona Republic newspaper, which is the largest newspaper in Arizona. And I've known him for a long time before and since, and he'd been involved in a lot of politics and stuff, so I knew his mind. And he was a speaker at the Arizona Breakfast Club. And we had, it was like 120, 150 people there. And he got up, and he said, blah, 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 media works this way, I'm great and wonderful, count on me. And I asked a question, and we really started to realize what was going to happen with the internet back in 94. So I think it was about 96, 97. And just to be a butthead, I said, the question was, how many weeks before the internet replaces the printed newspaper?
Mm-hmm.
And this was his response. He goes, well, it never will. Because you need to have a conservative newspaper like the Arizona Republic and a conservative editor like me to tell you what you need to know.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like,
nice
tape, please.
They come out and admit that, isn't it?
No, I was like, yep, tape, please. I actually said, I go, tape, please. Because this is how they think.
Yeah.
So I'm going, oh, man, these people, they don't see what's coming. And one thing that we do, I want to get your response to this. We have, I don't know if you've ever seen it, we do a lot of DVDs that we put out. And then, of course, we put a little card in there, it's like two or three times the size of a business card, and it just has the Revolution logo on top, and it has a guy throwing a, like these guys that are wearing the bandanas with a hat on backwards, like they're going to throw a Molotov cocktail, but they're throwing a bouquet of flowers, you know? So it's the Revolution, because that's the logo of how it was known in Europe. That's where we got that from. In France, the Revolution was all about this guy throwing a bouquet of flowers.
Mm-hmm.
And what we did is we put it, we took that, you know, ripped it off of them. They ripped off my Revolution thing, so we ripped that off. So we take and we put that together, and at the bottom it says, in quotes, it says, "We know the truth." And it came from Gary Franchi and I, a speech we gave in Washington, D.C. at the Revolution March there. Dr. Paul had a big thing. And we were like, you know, they say, yeah, but we know the truth. We know the truth. I get more pushback from the collectivists on the fact that I would even say we know the truth. And talking to Butler Schaefer, when it comes to this subjective truth thing, I'm going to get him to comment on that. Can anybody know the truth? We'll talk about that when we come back here on Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, and law professor Butler Schaefer.
There are those that just want to be left alone. And those that just won't leave them alone. Which one are you? The Ernest Hancock Show.
Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, and Professor Butler Schaefer from Southwestern University of Law in Los Angeles. The one thing I want to get right back to that question, and before we were so rudely interrupted by time, I mean, I'm just telling you, man, that's just the way it works, man. It's free market capitalism. One thing that I wanted to ask, that phrase, "We know the truth." We know, of course, what we were saying is that they, you know, that whatever the lamestream media, the media that's so last century is saying, that ain't the truth, okay? That is so not the truth. We know that they're lying. Well, that's pretty much the truth right there, in our opinion. But the one thing is that it's amazing the kinds of people that would come up to me, and we have all my back of my business cards, too. It has the same logo, and it says, "We know the truth." And a lot of people like, cool, you know, yeah, whatever. It may make them feel a little uncomfortable. That was kind of the point. But they come up and they say, "Truth? What truth? Who knows the truth? What's the truth?" And, you know, and the only answer I ever give, I go, you know, it's really interesting to me the type of people that ask me that question.
Mm-hmm.
And then they stare at me. I go, no, it's just interesting.
Yeah,
They're always the same kind of people. I'm like, I go, let me tell you what the truth is. It's not lies. That's what the truth is. At least it's not lies.
You know, when you mention that, it reminds me of a cartoon that appeared in Omni magazine years ago. I don't know if Omni's even still out.
No, it's not, but I used to read it a lot. I liked it.
They had one of these full-page cartoons showing, there was a series called The Artist, and they had this one artist out there painting something at his easel and his paints and so forth, and was painting some particular thing on the canvas, and some guy comes up and says, What are you doing? And he says, I'm painting. And he said, well, what's that supposed to represent? And he says, well, it's supposed to make you think. And the guy says, think about what? And the artist says, see, it's working already.
To me,
you know, the whole process of thinking, you know, if you want to call it truth seeking, it is a process. It's a way of trying to figure out, trying to understand the nature of the world we live in. And we really do a pretty good job when you think about it, at least in terms of our daily lives. You know, a farmer can believe that the earth is flat and still farm a pretty good crop of wheat. You know, we can function, and our ancestors did function quite well for many, many years believing that the sun traveled around the earth. So we can have a lot of errors in our thinking that are nonetheless, they don't they don't interfere with our ability to live well.
We had a newspaper that we've done different various issues of newspapers over the years, and whenever we get all motivated, we'll do, we haven't done it that much since the broad banning of video on the internet, and we have done one like last year. I think we did one, and we may do another one. They're very effective in, you know, limited ways. But one of the advertisers is a friend of ours. I hadn't talked to, you know, regularly in a long time. He's he's probably in his mid 50s, early 60s. He's really, you know, a successful investor and so on. And he has a couple of companies and everything. And we go golfing every now and then. And we're at the same kind of economic discussion groups and that kind of stuff. And we think along the same line. So we're friends. But all of a sudden, he was really excited about having an ad placed in that paper. And I go, sure, whatever you want to put in there. All it was, he had two big ads that were distributed throughout the paper, and it was just a big block of letters that said, think.
Mm-hmm.
And he said it was from, there was some kind of a campaign back in the 70s or 60s or something, or IBM or somebody was doing it. That was one of the campaigns. It was just think.
I think I remember that, yeah.
You know, and it had a big impact on him, and he wanted to just pass that on and as willing to help support the paper by doing that ad. And I got more comments from that than a lot of people going, why'd you do that? What was your, I go, I don't know. Did it make you think? Okay, well, fine. And I guess it worked, you know. So that's a powerful tool that we have.
Well, sometimes we just have to keep prodding ourselves, but the area that's difficult for us to prod is within the circle of our present understanding. You know, we can amuse ourselves with things from outside that circle if they aren't considered a threat to what we think we already know. But, you know, it's kind of like the notion of being skeptical. You know, we should be skeptical of the things that we hear and so forth. But are we skeptical of our own ideas? Are we skeptical of our own thinking? Oh well, no. I mean, that I got that nailed down. That's pretty tight. But if you say something that contradicts my body of knowledge, then I'm going to be skeptical about that.
Well, you know, that's why we always, especially on the show here, or when you're involved in any kind of debate or art of persuasion or running for office or talking to reporters or anything, you gotta try and have some kind of fundamental basis of understanding.
That's right, yeah.
And I don't, you know, that's one thing. Barry Hesse's a candidate for governor here as a libertarian. And I remember he always said that. He goes, first, let's define our terms.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes, we define our terms. Let's define what the heck each word means before we go any further. You go saying conservative or whatever. Okay, wait. What does that mean to you? I mean, what are you saying? Are you calling me a name? Okay, well, I might be upset. I don't know. What the heck do you think it means? And you liberal, okay. Well, what does that mean to you? So, you know, maybe that's not a bad thing. Maybe that's accurate as far as I'm concerned. So you go through this process first. And I found the one thing that really worked the best, of course, is this idea of self-ownership. You know, you put the hand on their shoulder and say, whose life is this? Well, you know, once you can get that, and if they go, no, well, it's somebody else's, well, then you're done. Let's talk about the weather. You know, there's no sense in wasting time with you. But the once you can get that base truth down, we can build on that together. Well, what's a base truth that you try and get somebody to even be able to communicate with them is? What do you use?
I think you have to relate it to something very specific in their life, something that they can relate to. As if it has something to do with education or whatever, what impact is this going to have on your children? Rather than just dealing with it as an abstraction, I think the more you can really personalize it, and sometimes it gets painful for people. You know, when people have lost a child in the war someplace, it's difficult to talk to them about the war system. And yet, you know, when are they going to start thinking about that?
Yeah, you know, a lot of people, they think about things like the education of their children. And he'll go, well, I'm doing the best for my child. I'm going to go. I'm doing really well because they're babysitting for me really good. So we'll go ahead and stay in, but I'll go complain once a month down at the PTA meeting. I mean, you know, once you show them, you know, what's really happening in comparison to what could be done. Yeah, so you drive a used car. Yeah, so mom stays home or dad stays home. Or you do, you know, yeah, you your child's only getting a couple of hours a day of instruction and learning 10 times as much. Yeah, he's going to be, you know, you do these kind of things to them, they will rationalize anything they can to not have to comply with actually taking some kind of effort.
Mm-hmm, right. Well, one of the things when we're talking about the notion of self-ownership, my last book that has been published so far was the Boundaries of Order book, subtitled Private Property is a Social System. I hear the...
I know, Boundaries of Order. Yeah, see, you're catching on. It's all that right. Commercialism stuff. Well, when we come back here on Declare Your Independence with Professor Butler Schaefer, we'll go ahead and talk about his Boundaries of Order book. That'll be a good place for us to come right back in, another great book by the author Butler Schaefer. We'll be right back.
There are those that just want to be left alone, and those that just won't leave them alone. Which one are you? The Ernest Hancock Show.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, dark sacred night, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
It really is. It's a wonderful, beautiful world. And government keeps screwing it up. Here on Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, we have Professor of Law Butler Schaefer from Southwestern University of Law in Los Angeles. And Butler, you're an optimistic guy. I mean, you know, it that comes across. You probably have a lot of pessimism for, you know, a lot of collectives and governments and structures and all that kind of stuff. But as far as individuals, humanity, I don't know, you're kind of on the plus side, do you think?
Well, I think so. If we can just get accustomed to dealing with each other as individuals. People often ask me, has an anarchistic society ever existed? Have you ever had one? I said, yeah. You live in one every day. Virtually everything we do in terms of our relationships with others is based on anarchy, isn't it? We go to the grocery store. We respect one another's boundaries. We don't go in there and start fights. We drive on the freeway. You know, we respect one another's position on the highway. You come over to our house, I can assure you, you're not going to have to show a passport or a visa. You're not going to be taxed. I don't have a prison in the basement. There's nothing that governments do. I'm not going to point a gun at you. Not going to do any of this stuff. We live in terms of our one-on-one relationships with other people on a very respectful basis. If you started behaving, let's say at work, the way governments behave toward us, if you started dealing with your fellow workers that way, you know, threatening them, pushing them around, smacking them around, tasering them, all this sort of stuff, you'd be fired in about 2 minutes. Same thing is true in social groups. You know, if you're a member of a bowling league or any other group, and you started behaving coercively the way the state does, you wouldn't be a member of that group anymore. So we just don't want you.
Well, let's talk about your what did you call it? Boundaries of Order?
Boundaries of Order. Subtitles, Private Property is a Social System. And it's based on the idea that as best I can tell, and I haven't found any contradictions to this, that all of our social problems, I'm talking about social problems, our dealings with one another, are all premised upon property difficulties. In other words, property violations, the failure to respect, or in some cases to identify, the inviolability of other people's boundaries. And you go through the newspaper, you go through any other source that talks about the issues of the day, they're all property-oriented. Everything from abortion to zoning laws, crimes, you know, the distinction between a victimizing crime and a victimless crime turns on whether or not there was a property trespass. Eminent domain, flag burning, should people be required to wear seat belts, product standards, prescription drugs, immigration as an issue, conservation, copyrights, gun ownership, on and on and on and on and on. Every one of these is a question that arises out of a failure to properly understand the concept of property.
Well, what is the concept of property?
Yeah, exactly. It starts, I think, with this notion of you're talking about before, of self-ownership. Do I own myself? This is a question I ask my students the first day of class in my property class. Do you own yourself? The case I have them start off with is the Dred Scott case, because that really deals with that. Is Dred Scott a person, or is he the property of his slave master? It's the same question that arises on the abortion question. For people who think that that issue was resolved by the 13th Amendment, it keeps popping up. Is the fetus, we want to call them that, a self-owning person, or is it an extension of the property of the mother? all these questions, they keep coming back. But it starts off with this notion of self-ownership. Do I own myself? If I do own myself, then there are certain things that follow from that. This goes back to John Locke and some others who had pointed out that, you know, to be a self-owning person, you have to be able to act upon the world in some way. You have to be able to occupy space. You have to be able to consume resources, whether it be air and water or food, whatever it may be. How do we allocate that? How do we decide who's going to be where? Everybody has to be somewhere at some point in time. How do we determine where that someplace is? Everyone has to consume resources. You can't survive long without being able to eat food, to breathe air, to drink water, and so forth. So, how do we make those kinds of determinations? And the choices historically have come down to individuals make these choices for themselves that are respected or not by our neighbors, or the state's going to make those choices. People like to argue that, well, in the Soviet Union, they didn't have property. Of course they had property. The Soviets controlled all of it. The first thing any particular regime does, a socialist regime does when it takes power, is seize property. Goes and, you know, takes control of the radio station or what else.
Well, how do you think it's going to manifest itself in the future as we spiral down as a country? The promise of whatever they were promising us to justify government's existence and reality of how screwed we are. And the only thing we're left with is the bill.
Well, and if we're dumb enough to pay it.
Well, I don't think that it's really even an option. It's so we have a sign right now that I'm looking at that some of the guys did yesterday. And you may have seen it if you went to Freedom's Phoenix and you saw Gary Franchi was here yesterday and we were talking about it. And I won't get myself in trouble, but you know, here we go. What we did is there was a gentleman named Taron Lupo that's a doctor that just kind of he went freedom oriented. He said, I'm out of here. Mm-hmm. And he does a lot of jewelry, you know, for the movement and so on like that. He's at a lot of these different functions, does podcasts and such. And I was at Porcupine Festival, and he had these signs that were red with white lettering on them, and they said paying taxes. And I'm going, what the heck are these for? Well, he sent us a bunch, And they're for putting on stop signs. It says stop paying taxes.
You know? So, I see. Yeah.
So we're going, okay, we get it. So the guys, yesterday they finished up this big black 4x8 sign. It has a little stent, it's a stencil sign. It has a Gerber baby up in the top left. And the question has the Gerber baby asking, you know, from our It's Not My Debt thing, we had that from. And it says, Mommy, what's a quadrillion dollars? And then it has a one with a whole bunch of zeros after it, a quadrillion, and underneath it has the revolution logo. So, you know, it's like, you know, this debt is so enormous, the point that we're making, and we did a video where you put in, you know, stop paying taxes up, and we put that graphic up with it, and Gary Franchi put it up on his website, and I put it up on mine. We do it, this little 30-second video, boom, it explodes. And we knew it would. And the point was that we're making is that these babies are not going to be able to pay this debt
right
back. It's not mathematically possible.
Yeah, it's going to collapse of its own dead weight. It's not something that, you know, people have to go storm the tax collecting office or something like that. It's just going to get to the place where it's both unenforceable and and even undefinable. You know, you get to the place
to
where
who?
You start,
you're going to give it to who?
You owe $300 million, Ernie, for your whatever it may be. You just shrug your shoulders and kind of, again, it's like the people who borrowed $500,000 on a $250,000 house. And, you know, what are they going to do? They're just going to walk away from it.
Well, now a lot of people have just stopped paying taxes. I mean, just stopped filing the IRS forms. Yeah, they're just going. Now, my wife, I do it. I got other battles to fight. And everybody's like, oh, see, you're paying taxes. You know, I go, look, man, I get them another way. But the thing is that my wife, Donna, you know Donna. And
sure.
She's pretty.
Say hello to her for me.
I will. She's. You know, Jane
says to say hello to you. So.
She is. Hi, Jane. She's just so mild-mannered, doesn't want to bother anybody. But you want to get my wife all worked up because I insist that she does the taxes. I'm not doing it. That's what keeps her libertarian. She is like, I hate it. I hate it. I hate it. I hate it. I don't want to do it anymore.
What you mean.
So I'm like, we'll see how many more years we go.
And now, live from the studios of Freedom's Phoenix, Ernest Hancock.
Yeah, more than a feeling. How about some factual evidence? You know, let's go ahead and try that. What the heck? Let's give that a shot. And I want to make sure that I do ask you this since I brought it up. This whole tax thing, you know, this 45 to my head, you gotta. And I don't know what people, you go, look, I'll fight that battle another day. You know, stop. You know, it's not an aggressive thing that you're doing. You're not going and storming the taxpayers, the tax house, or going up the White House or anything. You're just sitting there, you know, I'm good. I'm not playing. A lot of these young guys, they come out of college. They have no job. They're going, we're going to go agorist. We're going to go anarchist. We're going to go whateverist. And we're just not playing anymore. You know, you can't extract something out of me that I'm not, you know, getting anyway. So I'm just done. I'm sitting over here. I'm farming. I'm living in my grandma's basement. I'm working for cash, whatever, which like they got a choice now anyway. You know, do you advocate just kind of pulling out, or are you ready to just, I'm not filing taxes?
Well, I first of all, I don't really advocate other people to do much of anything that, you know, I can take my own position on various things, but I don't like giving people advice as to what they should do, particularly if I might not be around to, you know, help clean up the consequences of it. What I do advise people to do, and I think the thing that is going on right now that is most useful, is for people to think about this. And I don't mean just think about it that you're driving on the freeway and say, yeah, wasn't that a nice talk by Ron Paul, and then shift to something else. I mean, think about the implications of all this in detail, in you know, where it all leads. Why would I want to become or to remain simply a cog in someone else's machine, which is basically what we are. You know, we're even thought of, most of us in work environments, thought of in terms of resources. You know, when I was in law practice, the people in charge of the workforce are generally referred to as members of management or personnel or whatever. Now they're referred to as human resource directors. Resource. Think about that.
Who would change the terminology? I mean, it's almost like, I remember, I'll give you an example. It was, I don't know, 40s, 50s, whenever it was. It's this whole concept of marketing and public relations and this Freudian thing. You know, his nephew came over and did that's a whole another issue. But what they did is they go, we got some things that are just waste products. Mm-hmm. And like you have chicken wings. I mean, that was a throwaway, you know.
Oh, I've mentioned that to so many people, you know, back in that time period. That was garbage food.
You know, and then they had the term like bacon. You know, bacon was not, I don't remember, I think that was kind of, so what they did is they started inserting it just like they have in movies and television and so on for people smoking. They'd have, we need to have some bacon and eggs, bacon and eggs, bacon and eggs. That term, bacon and eggs, Judeo-Christian, whatever term that they want to put in there, they kind of, it infects the society, and it's intentional. And when you don't have any fundamental base principle that to protect you against whatever the ramifications are, this terminology and the definition behind it, it just fills the void.
Yeah.
So what do we need to put there first?
You also trace it back to your emotions. You know, you have an emotional response to something. Well, maybe your emotions are our emotions generally are warning signs that the unconscious perhaps telling us, you know, what this is isn't good for you. What this is, and not just in terms of food, but in terms of the commitments that people are trying to foist upon you.
You know,
isn't good for you. It's harmful to you. It's going to destroy you and so forth. Maybe your emotions, which tell you to run, to get out of it, to be angry and so forth, are worth listening to. And instead, what we have in our culture, anytime something that would otherwise excite our passions comes up, we're told what? Don't get emotional. Well, get emotional. Damn it.
You know, Nathaniel Brandon.
People get emotional. And instead of being the little, little zombies that we've created for ourselves.
Yeah, you don't want to violate another self-esteem by getting upset. You know, we have the Freedom Summit. We also have one of our a great speaker that was real popular with a lot of people, the Objectivist Nathaniel Brandon. And, and I don't know if I should call him that, or I guess so, but he was, the protege of Ayn Rand, and they had a relationship and so on, and that was interesting. Well, one thing that he did, is I remember he was a keynote speaker, one of the dinners that we had, and you know that you're going to have all of these objectivists around the Phoenix area in Arizona and the Southwest. Oh, here they come, man. They, you know, Nathaniel's talking, here they come.
A chance to check our premises.
You know, so they were in the back, you know, there's all together. It was probably, I don't know, a dozen or two dozen of them back there. They were really happy to be there and hear him speak. And then he said something I know upset him, and I want to get your comment on this. And he was talking about, we're talking about Ayn Rand. Oh, I asked a question. I go, you know, I was doing the Phil Donahue thing going around, and I said, you know, was she this pure logic and reason thing, or was she just a woman, you know? And man, you could have heard a pen drop there for a while, and he goes,
I remember that question.
Yeah, he goes, I don't know where you're sleeping, but I'm going, wait. You know, the point that I'm making is that, you know, was she, you know, I mean, was she all logic and reason, or was she also, you know, a female of the species? I mean, you know, was she a woman also? And with the emotions and everything that, you know, not, maybe not stereotypically go with that, but I mean, was she a woman? And he went on, he finally, when he got onto the subject, he said, Ayn believed that emotion was a shortcut. It was a reflex response to somebody, you know, jumping out going boo in the parking lot kind of thing. You're not thinking rationally, let me think this through, whether he's going to hurt. I mean, you reflex, you know, you coil back based on experiences and whatever. So emotion is a useful tool for us to be able to, you know, judge things based on experience or whatever. Well, you could see the objectivist in the back of the room getting out their steak knife, starting to saw through their wrists, okay?
Mm-hmm.
The fact that he would even say anything, mm-hmm. associate emotion with Ayn Rand or humanity at all.
This is where it goes back to this distinction between objective and subjective values. And, you know, I think the absurdity of her position on that was best reflected in how she chose various things that she favored, such as music or literary figures and so forth. You know, she favored Rachmaninoff over, let's say, Stockhausen or somebody like that. And because she liked Rachmaninoff, well, then Rachmaninoff was the objective composer. Stockhausen was something else. Mickey Spillane was a great writer. Victor Hugo was a great writer. James Joyce, I suppose, she would not have liked. But this is just all subjective preferences on her part. But she tries to elevate them into some sort of an objective truth. You know, to like James Joyce is to, you know, be a whim worshiper or irrationalist or something like that.
Well, emotion, I want to get your response on the usefulness of emotion, because you brought that up, is that we should pay attention to our emotions. Well, what's at the root of the emotion, though? What triggers them? Why?
That's right.
I don't know.
It has to do with we're making decisions in our lives that there's something within us, our inner voice is just simply saying, you know, this is destructive. This is self-destructive stuff.
So if you're feeling bad about a decision or an environment or a relationship or a position, there's a reason.
Well, and you might listen to it. It might be a stupid reason. Once you get into it, you might discover, you know, that was just, you know, some act of a dark side prejudice or something like that, and reject it. So it doesn't mean that whatever your emotions tell you is something, a valid kind of response, but it's something that is a response, and you'd better pay attention to it and at least, you know, kind of flesh it out and say, what is this all about? What does it tell me about me that I would have reacted to that?
And what is the base?
Emotions. We have this dark side, as Carl Jung was so fond of talking about. We have these tendencies to be and do things that we just don't want to do. You know, a tendency to be dishonest or violent or lazy or whatever, and we don't like feeling that way. So when we are feeling that way, we like to project it onto other people. You know, we see it in wars in particular. You know, all of the disorder in our society, it's the fault of quote them. In Germany, it was you know, Jews and homosexuals and communists and so forth. We're seeing the same thing being set up here, I think, in this country with regard to quote illegal immigrants.
Yeah, we got about 40 seconds. Go ahead, finish your illegal immigrants one.
Yeah, that.
Go ahead.
From the around which of this dark side is said before.
Yeah, I told him to bring that up.
Immigrants were streaming in from Canada. I don't think there would be the same response.
It's you know, the emotion is what we're being.
I know that's going to go over well in Arizona, but that's.
No, this, you know, that's one thing that next time we have you on, we can talk just about immigration. And, this is a fundamental. I wish we had more time. You know, Butler, I really appreciate you coming on. Butler Schaefer, professor of law, Southwestern University of Law in Los Angeles. We'll be right back.